It's a privilege to be able to be here with you today and giving this webinar for the National Association for Elementary School Principals. So diving straight into the conversation. Oh, and before I go any further, please do note that you do have the capability to enter comments or questions into the chat box. Please do use that throughout the presentation, and we'll try to monitor the chat box and answer any questions that we can as they arise, or as many as we can. So diving straight into the conversation for today, I've been studying the issue of children being expelled from preschool programs for about 15 or more years now. And in a way, that's like studying canaries in a coal mine. What I was initially interested in really was the conditions by which children enter into our preschool programs, our early childhood programs. What is the experience like for them? How can we do better by them? How can we help manage children's social-emotional development within the context of early learning centers? And some of the times when you're studying things like that, one of the ways to study it is by looking at the worst-case symptoms. And just like canaries in a coal mine, children being expelled from a preschool program would represent the worst-case symptom of when things aren't going so well for an individual child. And so when we first started studying this, we were primarily interested in understanding, you know, what's the rate by which children might get kicked out of a preschool program because of the challenging behavior. When we first did a study on this back in 2005, we found that children were being expelled from state-funded pre-K programs. These are pre-K programs operating largely in public school settings. We're being expelled, kicked out of the program for good at a rate more than three times that of grades K through 12 combined. And when we looked at child care programs that are operating outside of the public schools, then the rate was more than about 13 times that of grades K through 12 combined. And in other words, this is an awful lot of 3- and 4-year-old children who were being told that they can't make it in a preschool setting and were being kicked out of the program for good. So there's lots of different ways that we can look at rates like this. I mean, here again is the pre-K expulsion rate represented in terms of number of children expelled from preschool programs, mostly in the public schools, per 1,000 enrolled. And here is the K through 12 expulsion rate. And what would be the most similar thing for adults when thinking about being expelled from school? What would be the adult equivalent of it? You could maybe say being fired from your job. Or you could also say perhaps incarceration, because in a way, prison isn't just a place. Prison is also the absence of place. Prison means not here with us. I don't know where you're going. You're going to prison, but it also means you're not here in the greater society. And in a way, that's what expulsion is. It means you're not here in the greater society of children, the greater society of students, of learners. You're going to be someplace else. And so what is the adult incarceration rate in the United States? Well, it's about identical to the preschool expulsion rate. And when one looks at the degree of racial disparity in adult incarceration, it's almost identical to preschool racial disparity in terms of preschool expulsion rates. And the same thing for gender disparities. And so this in and of itself doesn't prove that there's a preschool to prison pipeline, but I suppose it does imply that if there is a preschool expulsion to prison pipeline, then it's fascinating how consistent the diameter of that pipe is all the way from preschool to adult incarceration. Exact same children who are at greatest risk of being expelled from a preschool program are the exact same types of adults who are at greatest risk for being incarcerated later on. There were some other studies when we first came out with these findings that had also been conducted at about that same time, and I won't go through all of these studies, and there's been a whole host of them since the ones that are on this slide here that I'm showing you. But take a look down at the Illinois study, and the reason I'm going to point out this one is going to be apparent in a second. 42% of the centers, these are child care centers in Illinois, in the state of Illinois, reported expelling at least one child in the past 12 months. But what's unique about this study is this. In the Illinois study, they were only looking at infant toddler child care centers. And so these data are only about babies. And so even with babies, with infants and toddlers, 0, 1, 2 years old, 42% of the centers reported expelling at least one infant or toddler in the past 12 months because of a challenging behavior. And I suppose this is also a good time to admit that when we first started talking about preschool expulsion, a lot of folks didn't necessarily like the term. They didn't want us to be calling it preschool expulsion or childcare expulsion, and we weren't quite sure what else to call it because it was children being told not to go to school anymore. And typically in K-12, we would call that expulsion. So I was giving a talk once to a group of early childhood educators, and one teacher raised her hand and said, "You know, I don't like it when you call it expulsion." And I thought to myself, well, I don't like it when you do it, but I didn't say that because not everything we think we should say or tweak for that matter. So instead, what I did was I said, "Well, what do you like to call it?" And I remember her saying, "Well, we like to call it in our center. We call it not yet ready for school ready." And we thought, well, I guess that sounds better. And does anyone else in the audience have something that they use as a term to call it preschool expulsion? And somebody else said, well, we call it, we're not the right place for your child. And then I said, anybody else? And somebody else said, we call it, and this one has been my all-time favorite. She called it in her center, they called it giving the child the gift of time. And I suppose that sounds lovely. And if you're giving away the gift of time, I could use some more time in my life. But in the end, regardless of what we call this, it's about children who are going to a school-like setting being told never to come back again because we don't know how to manage their behaviors. And at any other age level, any other grade level, we would be calling that expulsion. And what it basically means for these very young children is that they're getting an opportunity to experience school failure at an even earlier age. We hope that preschool program is an opportunity for children to be able to experience success, to be able to experience a love of learning at a younger age. But some of the times, if we don't come into this endeavor as prepared as we would like to be, it can become an opportunity for children to experience failure before they even enter into the kindergarten age doors. And so that's part of the concerns that we have for this. When we were first doing research on this, we were interested in what are the things that predict the likelihood that a child might be expelled from a preschool program. And so we looked at the data that we were collecting. These were all data collected from about 4,000 preschool teachers across the nation, randomly selected. And when we looked at the ways in which they were defining elements of their classroom, elements of their program, what it was that was happening in the classrooms, it became clear that there were several things that were indeed very strong predictors of the likelihood that a child might get expelled. Things like child-teacher ratios, as the number of children per adult goes up, the likelihood that one of those children will be expelled also goes up. Program length a day, half-day programs, school-day length programs, and programs that are open extended hours, 8, 9, 10 hours a day. The more hours the program is open, the greater the likelihood that some child isn't going to make it till the end of the day. Teacher job stress. The degree of job stress that the teacher reported that she herself experiences, specific to teaching, was also a strong predictor of the likelihood of expulsion. As teacher job stress goes up, so also goes the likelihood that the teacher might expel one of her stressors. And also teachers who screen positive for depression were expelling at about twice the rate of teachers who screen negative for depression. But conversely, on the other side, access to behavioral supports. The more access that a teacher had to somebody who can come into the classroom and provide real, live, in-the-moment assistance, the more access that a teacher had to someone like that, the less likely that she was to rely on expulsion or suspension in response to a child's challenging behaviors. Now, I'm not talking about more access to pamphlets or more access to in-service trainings or more access to webinars like this, but rather access to somebody who can actually come into the classroom and be a real live support in the moment. The more access to that, the less the likelihood that a child would be expelled. And so when we think about these are some of the best predictors of the likelihood that a child might be expelled from a preschool program. They all have one thing in common. And the one thing that they have in common is that none of them are about the child. None of these variables have anything to do about children or their behaviors. They have to do, these are not child variables. They're adult variables. They're us variables. They're variables that have to do with the way in which we have structured programs, the way in which we have structured the supports that we give to our teachers. And so when I think about it, and I understand that some of the best predictors we have of preschool expulsion are things within our control, then it leads me to this conclusion that preschool expulsion is not a child behavior. It's really an adult decision. It's a decision that we make about how we're going to respond to a child's behavior, or that we make regarding how we allocate resources to teachers and how we allocate resources within the program. And that these types of micro-level decisions at the ground and macro-level decisions in terms of how we allocate resources and how we conceptualize programs are really the thing behind whether a child gets expelled or not. The child's behavior obviously factors into it, but in the end, it's not just the child's behavior. It's really boiling down to adult decisions that we might make. So regarding this, who is it that's more likely to have this expulsion, this decision to be expelled? Well, again, with 3 or 4 year olds, and from the research that we have done in this national study, we know that in mixed-age classrooms where 3 and 4 year olds are together, that 4 year olds are about 50% more likely than 3 year olds to be expelled. And we didn't have any hypothesis going into this as to whether 4 year olds would be more likely or 3 year olds would be more likely. So we pulled together focus groups and asked these teachers, why would it be that teachers like you would say this, that 4 year olds were more likely? And they ultimately came to the conclusion that, well, it's because 4 year olds might be a little bigger than the 3 year olds. And so we said, well, why would that matter? And they said, well, because if a child is bigger, then the child might be bigger than some of the other children in the classroom. And if the child is bigger than some of the other children in the classroom, then maybe someone will get hurt. But if the child is smaller, then maybe the child will be less likely to hurt somebody. And I can understand maybe what they're saying, because I used to be a public school teacher myself, and I realized that as a teacher, your concerns aren't just about the individual child, but they also have to be about the classroom on the whole. When I thought about this, I kind of realized that, well, what they're saying is they're saying that it's really not about what the child's doing at all. It's about how the teacher experiences what the child is doing, how the teacher understands what the child is doing, and that if the child is bigger, then the child can have the same level of aggressive behaviors as a 3-year-old. But if the child is a 4-year-old and bigger, then the behaviors look more concerning simply because of a fear that somebody could get hurt, which means it's really not just about the child's behavior. It's about our adult imaginations regarding what that behavior might mean. We also found that black preschoolers were expelled at a rate more than twice as likely as white preschoolers, and boys were expelled at more than 4 times the rate of girls. And so when you put all 3 of these risk factors for having the decision of expulsion placed on a child, it gives you basically the 3 B's of preschool expulsion risk: big, black, and boy. And the more of those that exist within an individual child, the greater the likelihood that that child will be met with the decision to expel that child, even if all other factors are the same regarding that child's behavior. We first came up with these findings back in 2005. Later on, the Office of Civil Rights and the U.S. Department of Education started collecting data itself to be able to see whether this was true, surveying superintendents in public schools and asking data specifically about preschool expulsion rates. The first report came out in March of 2014. The second report came out in June of 2016. They ultimately found what it was that we found, that it indeed happens. It happens at a much higher rate than what one would expect, preschool expulsion, and that there are racial and gender disparities in it. The only difference that they found was that the degree of racial disparities that they were reporting was about 3 to 4 times that of white children. Of what we'd initially reported was only twice. And so what they were reporting was a greater level of disparity than what we had originally found. There was also a joint position statement that came out in 2014 from the Secretary of Health and Human Services and from Secretary Arne Duncan of the Department of Education. And this was a joint position statement condemning the practice of expelling children from early care and education programs, and for that to extend to public funded programs as well as private funded programs in the public schools, public programs outside of the public schools, and that we should be investing in things like early childhood mental health consultation and other ways in order to mitigate the likelihood that a child would ever be expelled at 3 or 4 years old from a preschool program. There's been some more recent studies looking at ACEs. These are adverse childhood experiences. There's a host of these adverse childhood experiences that have been shown in research to be related to adult health status, adult educational status, adult success, adult economic status. And when these researchers conducted this study with a very large sample of parents across the United Nations, across the United States, they basically found that every single one of these adverse childhood experiences, from domestic violence to family mental illness, adult substance abuse, victim or witnessing of violence, poverty, parental divorce, parental incarceration, every single one of these was related also to an increased likelihood of a child being expelled from preschool programs. And so when thinking about things like the adult substance abuse, one way of thinking about this is this, that one of the side effects of opioid abuse is that your preschooler may get expelled from preschool. One of the side effects of adult mental illness is that your preschooler may be expelled from a preschool program. So this, all these things together, and especially really the race disparities and the gender disparities, did raise to us the question of whether or not implicit biases about our boys, and especially our black boys, may play a role in these racial disparities. Is it possible that just the way in which we view children might impact the way in which we view their behaviors, and that if that's true, that that might impact the way in which we respond to those behaviors? So before I go much farther in describing what it was that we did to study this, I'm going to tell you a riddle that I sometimes use to try to describe implicit bias. Now, you may know this riddle, and if you do, please just hold the answer to yourself until the end. And then let's discuss what it is that makes this riddle work. So in this riddle, there is two men in a car, and they're driving down the road, a father and a son. So there's father and a son driving down the road, and unfortunately, they're in a very terrible car accident. And the father dies immediately on the scene. And the son has to be sent to the hospital, local hospital, in very critical condition, needs life-saving surgery right now. And so he goes to the hospital, the father's dead on the scene, son goes to the hospital, and the nurses are prepping the patient, and then they call in the top surgeon for the hospital to come in. And the top surgeon arrives, and the top surgeon is scrubbing in and getting ready for the surgery, and then the top surgeon comes in, sees the nurses preparing the patient, looks down at the patient, looks up at the nurses and says, "I can't do this surgery. That's my son." And some of the times when we tell this riddle to people, it's difficult for them to imagine, well, how could that be the surgeon's son if the father died in the car accident? And how could that be true? And I've heard people speculate, well, maybe it's because he has two dads. Maybe he's adopted. Or maybe he's got two dads because they're both gay. Or maybe he's a Catholic and the man in his car was his priest. And that's why it's his father. I mean, it could come up with all kinds of reasons, I suppose. But oftentimes when I tell this riddle, it's very difficult for some people to come up with the more simpler solution that perhaps the surgeon is his mother. And if that was hard for you to imagine, then that might be because of stereotype biases. That when I say surgeon, or when we say surgeon, there's an image that comes to our mind of what a surgeon looks like, who a surgeon is. And if that surgeon image doesn't include a woman, then this riddle might be very difficult for some people to think through. But if it does, then it might not be quite as easy. But don't feel bad if it was hard for you. It's not because of you. It's because of the images that we're bombarded with as to who is it to be likely to be a surgeon and who's more likely to be a nurse. And so if the prevailing image in American society was that a surgeon looks like this, that this is what a surgeon looks like in a hospital, then I wouldn't have been able to tell that riddle at all. I would have had, or I maybe would have had to tell it differently. I would have had to say two women are riding in a car, a mother and a daughter, in order for this riddle to work. The only way that this riddle works is because of stereotype bias. And so we were curious well, how does something like this actually function in the way in which we view children in our preschool classrooms, in terms of who is it that's more likely to be the child to give us the challenging behavior, and who is it that's less likely to be the child who might be the child who will give us, present with us a challenging behavior in a classroom. So we started doing this study back in January 2015 with some funding from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. It took us a while to find somebody willing to fund something like this, but the W.K. Kellogg Foundation were very generous funders of the work that we did. We collected data in 2015, released a report in 2016. You can see a copy of it there. It's available online. The participants were were 132 preschool teachers from across the United States, and you can see some basic demographic information there about who they actually were. And what the teachers did was they were instructed to sit in front of a screen. We had a screen for them, and we played a video. And the video was about 6 minutes long, and it was a video of four children. You can see them on your screen right now, sitting at a table. And the picture was taken, the video was taken from a variety of different angles so that we could move the children around on the screen. And what we told the teachers was this: we're going to show you a video of four children in a busy preschool classroom. And really the secret to being able to manage challenging behaviors is to be able to see challenging behaviors before they become too problematic. Please watch this video. We're going to have an eye tracker that's going to be able to measure exactly where you're looking on the screen, down to 1/1000th of a second. And I want you to hit this button here every time you see a child do something that could lead to a challenging behavior. And we're going to record how accurate you are at being able to predict whether a challenging behavior is about to happen. So that's what we told the teachers. What we didn't tell the teachers was this. We didn't tell the teachers that we do have four children here. And if you'll notice, we have two children who are black, two children who are white, two boys, two girls. And we didn't tell them that you're not going to see any challenging behaviors at all. And we know that because these children are child actors that we placed at a small round table in a preschool classroom, and that we've asked to play with Play-Doh. That's their job for the day. And so we're not really looking to see if you can find challenging behaviors, because there really aren't any to find. What we're really interested in is this: when I lead you to believe that a child might misbehave, who do you look at? Which child do you look at the most? Which child do you look at the first? Which child do you go back to because must have missed something? In other words, if you weren't a preschool teacher, but instead you were a mall cop, who would you be following at the Gap right now? That's what we were really interested in. And so to give you a sense of what it was that these preschool teachers actually saw, here's a 15-second clip. And the teacher saw 6 minutes of this. Did you see the misbehaviors? I'm going to guess not, because there really weren't any to be seen. But teachers saw 6 minutes of that from a variety of different perspectives while we were measuring where on the screen were the teachers actually looking for the challenging behaviors. This will give you a sense of what it looked like. We recreated the eye tracking experiment at a local preschool program. Here's a preschool teacher, and here she is looking at the screen. And then here's Maria. She's a research assistant on the project. She sees the same thing that the teachers saw, except on her screen, she sees a little yellow dot. That yellow dot is where that teacher is looking right at that particular moment. And because we know where the teachers were looking, we were able to then define which children were where, and then be able to calculate how much time the teachers were spending looking at one child versus another child. At the end of the experiment, we showed them pictures of the four children that were in the study, and we asked them, please remember the letter of the child you believe required the most of your attention. And then so the teachers had to look at this, and we didn't tell them that we're still tracking their eyes. We know what letter you look at. And then the screen goes blank. And then we asked them to enter the letter. And the reason that we did it this way is because we wanted to break the study down into three components. The first one is, for the first 6 minutes, where do your biases take your eyes in terms of who do you expect to misbehave? And then when the when we get to this part point in the screen, are you aware of where your biases may have taken your eyes? And then when the screen goes blank, are you willing to tell us? Are you willing to admit where it was that you were looking the most? Because we can't really do much regarding implicit bias in classroom until we know more about how it's wired. How are implicit biases wired? And is it possible that the teachers actually were aware of the fact that they might have been looking more at some children than at other children? There was a second part of the study where we provided teachers with a vignette about a child who has some very significant behavioral problems in preschool. We altered the name to either imply a black boy, a black girl, a white boy, or a white girl. And then we had the teachers rate how severe this behavior problem would be if this were to happen in their own classroom. But we also randomized them to a different condition. Some teachers got a second paragraph, and the second paragraph explained more about the child's challenging home life conditions. It gave some information about the parent's life, about stressors in the home, stressors in the community. What we were interested in was this: as teachers learned and knew more about the home life of children, is it possible that the behaviors wouldn't seem quite so bad after all? That they would understand and be able to see maybe where these behavioral challenges are coming? And so as a result, is it possible that teachers understanding and knowing more about the inner lives of children and families would be an antidote? In other words, is it possible that bias is about the stories that we make that dehumanize people when we don't really know them well, and we put them into category and then make assumptions on the basis of those categories? This child is like this because he looks like that. This child looks like this, so I'm going to make these sets of assumptions. And that if that's the case, then maybe the best way to be able to combat that is to rehumanize children through telling their stories. I noticed a long time ago in studying children being expelled from preschool programs that I hear a lot of stories about how children are expelled and which children get expelled and which ones don't. But one story that I almost never hear told is this. I never hear told a story about a child who was expelled from a preschool program when the teacher and the parent knew and liked each other. I just virtually never hear about that. And I couldn't like randomize people to like the parents in these stories, but I could randomize how much information, how much did they feel they knew about the parents. And is it possible to just feeling like you know the parent more will make it less likely that you would resort to expulsion as a solution for a challenging behavior? And so instead of me telling you what it was that we found, I'm going to let Corey Turner of NPR News Education tell you in this brief 2-minute blurb where he covered our research.
There's a new study at the Yale Child Study Center that I had to read a few times just to believe what it was telling me. The researchers recruited about 135 preschool teachers. They had them watch video footage of 4 kids playing, a black boy, a black girl, a white boy, and a white girl. And they told the teachers, their subjects, watch the video, there may be some challenging behaviors. As soon as you see something that could become challenging, hit the enter key on your keypad. Well, here's the trick. There was no challenging behavior. The researchers were using iScan technology to see which child the teachers were looking at the most. And what they found is that the teachers, both white and black alike, spent the most time watching the black boy, waiting for bad behavior that never came. There's one more really interesting headline in this study, which comes later. The teachers were also given a 1-paragraph description to read of a hypothetical child with a stereotypical name who behaves pretty badly in class, pushes, scratches, throws toys. And some of the teachers were also given some biographical information that helped make sense of that behavior. They were told that the child lives with his mother, a father has been in and out for years, they're relatively poor, the mother is depressed, works 3 jobs. Researchers wanted to know if knowing this information made the teachers more empathetic to the kid. Well, here's the shock. It did, but only if the teacher and the child were of the same race. If the teacher and the child, a white teacher and a black child, or even a black teacher and a white child, knowing that biographical information, those teachers were less empathetic towards those students. And here's why this matters. Imagine if this is true, if there's this empathy deficit in preschool, well, imagine where else that's true.
Walter, I'm not hearing you.
Oops, I'm sorry. Thank you. I forgot to unmute myself. So this is from Corey Turner at NPR News Education, and this is him summarizing some of the things that we had found in the original study. And some of the things that they're repeating is that when teachers are led to believe that a child might misbehave, teachers, both black and white and brown, spent more time watching black children, especially the black boy. But when we asked them who they thought they were looking at most, they thought they were looking more at boys, especially the black boy. Either way, the black boy ended up at the short end of the stick. But the underlying bias that impacted where their eye gaze went was more related to race. But what they thought was that it was more related to gender, more of a boys will be boys kind of bias. And then the other part of the study basically was that we kind of found what we wanted to find or expected to find, that the more information teachers knew about a child's background, the more empathic they might feel to the child's behaviors, the more they might understand where it comes from. But it was a limited finding. We only found that if the teacher and the child were of the same race. But if the teacher and the child were of a different race, the more background information we gave the teacher, the worse the behavior problems seemed, and the more hopeless the teacher became that anything could ever be done to solve it. And so we became concerned that, in fact, perhaps it's not that more information helps teachers become more empathic, but rather that more information helps teachers become more of what they were already feeling about this child. And if they feel that this child might be similar to their own children or their own nieces or nephews, and I can relate to this child's story, then more information might indeed increase empathy. But if this child has already been otherized in the life of the teacher, and this child looks very different than any child that would be in my life, the more information we gave them, the more otherized the child became, and the worse the behaviors appeared, and the more hopeless the teacher reported feeling that anything could ever happen that would improve this child's behavior. I was giving a talk similar to this last February, and it was in Las Vegas, Nevada, and I gave a talk about implicit bias in preschool classrooms, and then there was another speaker who talked about implicit biases in the court systems. He was a court judge, and talking about how biases might impact decisions like termination of parental rights and things like that. And he spoke, and then I spoke, and we sat down, and then we were having lunch, and I got my lemon chicken, because at a conference it's always lemon chicken. So I'm sitting there with my lemon chicken and eating that. And then the MC, you see her on the right hand of the screen there, came up to the stage and brought with her a young girl. And when I was giving the talk, I didn't notice anybody in the audience that seemed much younger than 30. So I was a little surprised to see somebody her age there. And the MC actually asked, well, you know, we were a little interested to hear what brought you here. We don't see any other children at this conference on implicit bias. And she said, well, I came here with my mom. And then the MC said, well, what did you take from this? What things stood out to you? And she said, well, I noticed when that one researcher person, that one professor guy, said that he was talking about how teachers look at kids like me. And when she said that, I'll admit that I was concerned and I was worried. And the thing that I was worried about is I was worried that maybe I'd said something that might hurt her, that might impact the way in which she would view teachers. And I try to remain cognizant when I give talks like this that I'm not really talking about how we typically view in education children who look like my white daughter. I'm talking about how we might be viewing children who don't look like my white daughter. But I wasn't anticipating that I would be saying this to someone who actually is a child, who actually is a student. And so I'll admit that I was worried that I might have hurt her or offended her. And the MC then asked a follow-up question. She said, well, and how did that make you feel? And then I became very worried. I wanted to hear what her answer was, but at the same time I was very concerned about what the answer might be. And then she said something, this little girl, I will never, ever, ever forget. She said, well, me and my friends, we already knew it. We just didn't think you all did. And I'll never be able to forget that, because she really taught me a lot of things saying that. She taught me, one, that maybe I shouldn't worry so much about saying this to children, that I'd be the most concerned that I would hurt. They already know it, and they've known it longer than I've known it, and they'll know it at a depth that I can never be able to experience it. The other thing that she taught me too is that some of the times we as adults and teachers, we view our behaviors with children filtered through the lens of our best intentions. But children, they view our behaviors in its pure form, not filtered through the lens of our best intentions. They just see the behavior itself. And in many cases, they might be the very best reporter of how we behave with them across racial and gender lines, and how our biases may impact the way in which we behave with them, because they're viewing our behaviors unbiased by an appreciation of what our best intentions are. They're just experiencing just the behaviors in their purest sense. So I'm going to, before I talk more about things that we can do regarding this, I want to be able to make this point, and that whatever it is that we do regarding an issue like implicit bias or anything having to do with equity or inclusion, it needs to be a whole school solution. It can't be just something that's implemented by the teachers. It needs to be something that's embraced by the teachers, the assistant teachers, the administration, the person who greets the children at the door, the lunchroom staff, the school bus drivers. And so to make this case, I'll play for you this one brief video from the Atlanta Speech School in the Rollins Center in Atlanta, Georgia.
Hey, Mr. Q!
Did you see that? Why would somebody do that?
Please go into the classroom, no talking, quietly.
Hey, Miss Myrna, how you doing?
We need you inside.
How do you think that makes us feel?
I forgot my number.
What's your name?
Jordan.
What's your last name?
Carter.
All right. Go ahead.
School is hard enough.
Come on in, sit down quietly at your desk, and begin writing.
This kind of stuff just makes it harder.
I said quietly, please. Who's talking? Is it you, Sophie? Don't let it be you.
Don't believe me?
Sophie.
Please just watch.
I'm not up here for me. I'm up here for you. Pay attention. Okay? Now somebody answer me. Somebody needs to answer me really fast.
Every time we're ignored or yelled at or silenced, the teacher takes away what's possible.
No horseplay, no running, and especially no talking.
Moment by moment.
Miss McGarity. Your student's behavior yesterday in the lunchroom, it was terrible. Next time, silent lunch.
Did you hear that? Stay in line and catch a bubble. I'm not playing.
If this is education, we're in trouble.
Bye, Miss McGarity.
Frederick Douglass said, "Once you learn to read, you'll be forever free." The way it is now, two of the three of us will never be able to really read. It doesn't have to be this way.
Hey, Jordan. How you doing?
Good.
Good.
Everyone we meet throughout our day can make a difference.
I've been waiting for you to arrive.
All the difference.
Good. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Great.
Hi. Hi, Jordan.
Good morning, Jordan.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for asking. How are you?
Good.
Go ahead and put your number in.
Talk with us.
I don't know my number.
Not at us.
That's okay. I'll look it up for you. Go ahead, sweetheart.
Okay.
All right.
Teach us what we need to know. That's how we get smarter.
Well, good morning, Sophie, Janicia, and Jordan.
And when you talk with us and teach us, give us bigger and bigger words.
Now what I'd like you to do, children, is turn around and converse with your neighbor and discuss where the mother might have gone.
Words that we can use to read and understand.
She is prey for eagles, so she hunts at night.
And that will take us places we can never reach without you.
Remember, we're entering the learning zone. Now, how can we show our respect to the children and teachers who are working?
We can walk quietly.
Yes.
Okay, kids, so what I'd like you to do is continue writing your narrative, documenting your emotions, if you were the baby owl and your mother abandoned you in the nest.
What can you do? Learn all that you can so that you can challenge us to be our best.
You would have stayed and assisted them in whatever they needed.
Share yourself with us and show us how to share ourselves with others. Give us courage. Give us compassion. Help us find our own voices so we can become who we are meant to be.
Why would you want to silence us?
So the main purpose for showing you that video was to make the point that whatever it is that we do on an issue that has to do with the overall climate of the school, or a topic like equity and inclusion and things like this, it would really need to involve every one of us, every single adult that's in that building, not just the lead teachers, but also the custodial staff. I remember going to a school once where the person who was greeting children at the door explained to me that he had the most important job in the school. And I said, well, why? Why do you have the most important job in the school? And he said, well, it's simple, because whatever I say to these little children when they walk into the building sets the tone for how they will receive and hear everything else that's said by anyone else in the building. And I think he's right. You know, and so the next time that we think about diversity and inclusion trainings or equity trainings, we should also ask ourselves within our own schools, within our own buildings, how are we thinking about equity in terms of who should be in that room and what adults would we want to put on that invitation list? To tell you more about some of the work that we've been doing recently to try to figure out ways to address things like challenging behaviors in classrooms and also implicit bias and how implicit biases might impact the way in which we view those, we've been developing systems by which mental health providers, psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers are retrained to work directly with early care and education providers. They need to have retraining in order to be able to know how to work in early childhood settings. But one of the things that we were curious about was, what if instead of children having challenging behaviors in preschool settings and being expelled from the preschool program and ending up in a child guidance clinic, what if instead we expelled the clinicians out of the clinics and put them into the preschool programs where they could maybe be a source of prevention by working directly with teachers in early childhood settings? And in random controlled trials in the state of Connecticut, found that not only is the program highly effective at reducing challenging behaviors, but it's far cheaper than anything else than we could possibly fund. It's far cheaper than paying for another year of early care and education because the child hasn't learned enough to be ready to go on into kindergarten. It's far cheaper than early childhood special ed, or the difference in cost between early childhood special education and regular education. It's far cheaper than outpatient psychotherapy. And so when we have a solution that's both effective and cheaper than the alternatives that we currently do, that's a solution that we're advocating for. Another one is to actually measure the way in which we interact individually with each and every child, and to measure issues of equity in terms of how we approach that in classrooms. I used to believe in education that we tended to measure the things that we value, but I've since come to learn that it's really the other way around. We just value whatever we measure. And if we can start measuring how we treat each and every child, instead of measuring how we treat children on the whole or on average, that might be a step further. Most of our measures that we use to measure the quality of interactions in preschool classrooms and early childhood classrooms measure what the lead teacher is doing with the majority of the children the majority of the time. And as long as we're measuring how the majority of the children experience the educational setting the majority of the time, we are on purpose missing issues of equity, because equity is not about how we interact with the majority of the children the majority of the time. It's about how we interact with each and every child individually. And so until we get to the point to where our measures are starting to reflect that, then we'll never be valuing the experience of each and every child, and we'll never be able to actually be able to measure and do much about issues of inequity in these classrooms. And so some of the things that we've been focusing on is, well, how do you measure this better? And how do you set up interventions more specific to helping teachers realize how best to interact with each child individually and how to understand their biases in a way that will allow them to be able to utilize their biases instead of having their biases utilize them? One of the things that I've learned about implicit bias in the past is that it's hard to see. As a matter of fact, you can't really see it. It's kind of like the wind. You can't see the wind, but you can see its effect. You can see the effect of the wind. And bias is kind of like that. You can't really see it, but you can see its effects. And how do we help teach all those who work with children for a living how to be able to see the effects of their own biases and to be able to appreciate their biases so that they can utilize their biases as a lens on how this child is experiencing me and others, instead of having their biases just use their behavior and shape their behaviors in ways that we might not even be aware of. In terms of recent policy changes on this, just in the past 3 or 4 years, we've had 26 states acting on data like this by creating statewide systems of early childhood and health consultation and infusing equity and things like that into early care and education settings in a way to be able to reduce preschool expulsion and suspension. That's 26 states that really weren't doing nearly as much in that topic, but have since started to in just the past 3 or 4 years. Just in the past 3 or 4 years also, 15 states completely banning preschool expulsion and suspension. And several of those states have legislative or regulatory bans, not only on preschool expulsion and suspension, but expulsion and suspension in grades kindergarten or maybe even 1 and 2. Connecticut here is an example of that. Our statewide ban is a ban on expelling any child grades preschool through grade 2, except in some very certain extreme conditions. And part of the reason why I think that was a good ban in Connecticut is because we already had a statewide system for providing supports to teachers so that they could have an alternative other than preschool expulsion. And it was a system that's funded by and provided by the state. So it came in as no cost to the schools. And so what we wanted to do is we wanted to be able to not only have a system by which we're supporting teachers so that they can make other decisions and administrators so they can make other decisions, but also to send a clear message that expelling a child, especially a 3 or 4 year old child or a baby, is not really the best way for us to be supporting a child's entry into school. And so part of the other way of thinking about it is this too. If that's true, then the opposite is true. We shouldn't be banning preschool expulsion and suspension without giving teachers and administrators the supports that they need in order to be able to make different decisions. Real live supports, again, not webinars and pamphlets to read, but somebody who can really come into the classroom and provide the supports needed and to model other alternative ways of interacting. And part of this might eventually also mean more funding for things like therapeutic preschool programs for some children who might have a very difficult time because of their trauma background to be able to immediately enter into a more typical early care and education setting, to be able to have a place by which they can learn the skills necessary for them to be able to be successful in your more typical early childhood settings, because that should be the goal of early education, is to help each and every one of our children be able to succeed at the best possibility, the likelihood that they will be able to succeed once they get into kindergarten in grades 1, 2, and 3 and up. I'll end this by saying just a little bit about some of the reasons why I think that we should care about a topic like this. I talk a lot with decision makers, say, about early care and education and why we should be investing in early care and education. And I'm going to assume that many of you have heard phrases like every dollar that's spent on early care and education yields $7.16 in societal savings by the time the child is 27 years old, or yields $17 by the time the child is 45 years old. And these findings are based on return on investment studies, economic investment studies that were done with a handful of early childhood experiments where children were randomized to either attend a high-quality preschool program or randomized, in most cases, to not attend a high-quality preschool program. And for the most part, there's really 3 studies that we cite over and over again to make the case for why we should, as a society, be investing in early care and education. We have the Perry Preschool Study in Ypsilanti, Michigan. There's a study that began in the 1960s, and it was 123 children in Ypsilanti, Michigan, randomized to either attend the high-quality preschool program or randomized to not. The number 2 most widely cited study is a study called the Abbotsiderian Study in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. and the number three most widely cited study to make the case for why we should be investing in early care and education at all is the Chicago Child Parent Center study. And again, these three studies get cited over and over and over again by people like me because in large part they have a return on investment component to it that allows us to be able to look at how much money was spent on the program and then how much money did it save later on. But there's some things that we don't typically mention when we're talking about issues like this, or people like me that might not mention to decision makers. And that's this, the Perry Preschool study, the study that's cited the most when making the case for early care and education, is a study of 123 children in Chapel Hill in Ypsilanti, Michigan. And every single one of those children in the study, every single one of them were black. And the number two most widely cited study to make the case for early care and education was in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. 98% of that sample in that study were black. And the number three most widely cited study to make the case, the Chicago Child Parent Center study, 93% of the children and families in that study were black. In other words, what we've done is we've gone into our communities of color, predominantly African-American communities, and obtained from our black children, our black families, our black community data to create a preschool program system and childcare system in the United States to benefit all of our children. And that's good. But then when no one's paying attention, we kick out the back door the children who gave us the data in the first place. Those black and sometimes brown children and families who gave us the data, whose data purchased early care and education in the United States, are the very first to get disenfranchised from the very programs that would not have existed without their participation in the early research that made the case for why we should have these programs. And so when you think about it, social justice and civil rights are often matters of access. They're about getting into something, and that could be access to a seat on a bus or access to a seat at a deli counter, access to voting. It could mean access to higher education, or it can mean access to a seat in an elementary school. But access isn't just about getting in the front door. It's also about making sure that you're not pushed out the back door, too. And that's why I care about a topic like this. I care about it because it's the right thing to do in terms of thinking about education, and it's the right thing to do in terms of thinking about how we invest in our children and a future in America, but it's also just the right thing to do, period. And so I'm going to end by acknowledging my team. I've got a wonderful, amazing group of people who work with me every day. This is just a few of them, and there's a whole host of other ones, too. And certainly for a lot of the research that we've been doing specific on this case, supported by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. And I'll leave there with an opportunity for you to ask any questions that you might have. And please feel free to use the chat box to initiate any questions if you would like. I'm happy to try to read out the questions and answer them. Thank you.
Dr. Killian, while we're waiting for folks, I would encourage them to use the chat box. I have a question for you. What would be the top three strategies you would recommend for principals to maybe address this implicit bias issue in their school? What should they do?
Well, here's one thing that I would suggest. I would think about having real conversations about bias and about how we view children and families by bringing in people who actually do this for a living. There are indeed people who do lead some really good anti-bias experiences. Now, I wouldn't bring in somebody to just lecture people. That's not going to be very helpful. But if you can bring somebody who can facilitate conversations on this, that would be spectacular. That would be one thing. But I'll caveat that by saying that it also depends on how you do that. It's not just about doing that. It's about how you do, like, who do you invite into the room? And if the only people that you invite into the room are people who are the lead teachers in classrooms, but not others that are in the bigger ecosystem of the school, then that in and of itself is setting a statement about who it is that's important to be engaged in this. We need to have these conversations in a very inclusive way. We can't have conversations about inclusivity in a non-inclusive way and with a non-inclusive invitation list. The second thing that I would recommend is to actually have more experiences that put teachers and parents and teachers and administration in close contact with each other in ways that aren't just about children's success and children's grades. If the first time that a teacher and a parent come in contact with each other is because of a challenging behavior, that's going to be a challenged relationship. Is it possible to have other ways in which teachers and parents get to know each other? Can we do that through cookouts? Can we do that through other kinds of experiences that have teachers and parents mingling together? Opportunities for parents to bring their own children and families into an experience that the parents in the school also will experience. The more we see and view each other as individuals and as real people, the greater our chances and likelihood of being able to break down the barriers that we erect in order to separate us from each other. And then the third thing that I would recommend is more proactive kinds of ways of dealing with challenging behaviors, things like early childhood mental health consultation, or things like positive behavioral supports. Anything that we do that's more preventative in nature gives a vehicle for the possibility of discussing the way in which bias might have been impacting the way in which we view that child's behaviors.
What great suggestions. That's awesome. And if a principal has identified, you know, maybe some people that do have bias, are there suggestions for how they might, you know, work on specific behaviors?
That's a great question. Well, first off, I'm not sure exactly how we identify specific staff that may have specific biases. That's a challenging thing, and so it would be what we're working on here in my section at the Edward Ziegler Center in Child Development and Social Policy here at Yale is we're trying to develop systems by which we can do full 360 evaluations of teaching staff, where we can get to reflect on ourselves and reflect on others as a way to be able to open up conversations about bias in a less threatening way. One of the challenges of talking about things having to do with biases is that some of the times it can be heard by people as, well, if you're saying that I have a bias, then you're saying that I'm a racist. And that would be a very extreme way of viewing the topic of bias. Just because somebody has a bias doesn't make them an overt, on purpose, explicit racist. Because the reality is we all have biases, each and every single one of us. And so I suppose my answer to this would be this. I would be less surprised if a principal identifies somebody who has a bias than I would be if an administrator was able to identify somebody who didn't. Because the fact is we all have them. And if we talk about this as a stigmata of shame, then we will never be able to talk about it at all.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for everything you've shared. Denise has written into the
chat
box, parent partnerships is a key component of the corner model. Excellent presentation. So again, thank you so much, everyone, for joining us.
And I agree with her completely. The Comer model was developed right here at Yale University by James Comer. So thank you so much for plugging my dear colleague and mentor.
Any final words for us, Dr. Gilliam, before we leave?
Nothing other than thank you so much for being a part of a conversation like this. And please take whatever elements of this you would like to those who weren't able to join us today. We need to have more conversations, I think, especially the conversations that might feel a little uncomfortable.